Welcome to the fifth Sunday of Lent. It's almost over, you know. The long season is about to come to an end. We only really have one more full week, and after that, Holy Week, and then the Triduum. For us, perhaps it marks the end of a period of temporary privation. No M&Ms or martinis or Facebook for these 40 days. Or perhaps we've done something a little harder. We've dared a bit more, depriving ourselves of something deeper. More destructive habits or practices going forward, not just for 40 days, but for our lifetimes. For us, Easter becomes the tomb in which we bury our old selves and from which we emerge, wedded to a more constructive, beneficent life. In the fourth gospel that we have come to call John, Jesus' life is curiously punctuated at one end and the other by a wedding and two funerals. Now, it's been more than a year. It was last January, actually, January 2017, when we last heard the story of the wedding at Cana. And that was the formal start to Jesus' public ministry in this gospel. It was also his first miracle, at least in John's gospel. On that occasion, you will remember, he had tried to derail his mother, who wanted some action from him. He told her that his hour had not yet come. In the gospel that Doug just proclaimed this morning, we're coming to the close of that public ministry. And although we didn't hear it this morning, earlier in this same chapter, he had performed his final and seventh miracle, the raising of Lazarus from the dead. Now, back at Cana, he had protested that he couldn't deal with the wine situation because his hour hadn't come yet. But in this morning's gospel, he tells the disciples and anybody who's standing around that his hour has indeed finally arrived. The resuscitation of a dead man only a few miles from downtown Jerusalem at the beginning of the potentially riot-laden Passover week would surely get him into the most trouble of his ministry thus far. It turns out he was right. It turns out that this hour of which he speaks refers to his passion, death, and resurrection that will happen very shortly. The only thing that will occur in the gospel between what we heard this morning and the arrest and his eventual passion is that last dinner with his friends. So John's take on Jesus' life and ministry begins over here at Cana with a taste of what is to come with him. Life with Jesus is going to be like a wedding. Lots of happy people, new life excitement, and lots of choice wine. It's sort of like a nonstop wedding. And in fact, that's how it metaphorically unfolded with Jesus in this particular gospel. Lots of helpful teaching and preaching and feeding and healing and nurturing and raising to new life. It's a good life, good wine indeed. But in this morning's gospel, on the day before the last meal with his closest companions, the day before his arrest, John gives us a sense of what life will be like with Jesus going forward, and incidentally, what life will be like for his earliest followers. There will be suffering and death, to be sure, but just as it had been with Lazarus, so it will be with Jesus. The anticipated funeral will be interrupted. Very early on a Sunday morning, death will be, surprisingly, not the expected end. New life, unimaginable life, will follow, not only for Lazarus and not only for Jesus on Easter morning, but for everybody who follows him on the way. Now, once again, in the last couple of weeks, we in the 21st century in North America have been treated to an uptick of horrors trailing the inevitable funerals in their wake. Once again, children have been taken from us too early by somebody toting guns to school. As of this week, in fact, yesterday afternoon when I last looked it up, there have been 18 shootings in American schools since the beginning of this year. Now, in the wake of these horrors, we wring our hands and say, no more. And lawmakers tend to get a bit excited and posture about licensing and laws. And the NRA claims the problem is mental illness, not firearms. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And so it has been since the first really shocking round of gun violence in our educational facilities 19 years ago at Columbine. Funeral after funeral after funeral. And then it happens again and again, ad nauseum. But a new hour has come. Last week, something new happened. It's made the rounds in social media as hashtag enough. It's made the news. It's disrupted traffic and the normal routine of ordinary school days. Students, sometimes joined by parents and administrators and faculties, have walked out of their schools for 17 minutes to protest the 17 lives wasted. Now, their protest has had its inevitable counter-protests. Students have suffered backlash from all kinds of people, including from their own schools. One teenager, a senior in high school, the child of a friend of mine, knowing that there would be consequences, he had been told this ahead of time, knowing that there would be consequences from school administrators if he walked out, and in his case, the consequences was corporal punishment. He walked out anyway because he thought witnessing to the need to stop the violence was more important. Now, there's something about death and about funerals that's sobering. In an odd way, it's also courage-making. These kids were gutsy. It's true. But they were also demonstrating something else. Out of death, life. Out of despair, a hope that things can and must be different. Out of a sense of helplessness, strength, and determination. Now, I'm not equating these kids' actions with the martyrdom of the earliest Christians who followed Jesus on the way, nor am I saying that they are Jesus brought back to life and walking the streets of America. But they were martyrs in the ancient sense of that word. They were witnesses to a better way. This is what one of those kids' mothers said about him the other day. Wiley has been trained by all the Christian formation that he has received over the years to have the law and love of God in his heart and to not be afraid to lose his life for the sake of love. On Wednesday, he was the innocent one, the one who had done no wrong, standing in solidarity with those who are losing their lives because of the violence in this world. And as a consequence, He became the recipient of violence himself. I must tell you, he's an Episcopal kid. In John's gospel, Jesus knew what he was facing, his own suffering and death and inevitable funeral. He knew way back when he took his first steps at Cana toward his hour that this is where he was headed. He knew it as he healed people inappropriately on a Sabbath or ate with people considered unclean or unacceptable, or he called disciples from among the illiterate and the unwashed. He dared to buck it, for the good of the people, especially for innocent people. And he did all of this knowing that Rome and certain high mucky mucks, religious mucky mucks, would disapprove mightily. And in John's gospel, he knew it would lead to that Friday that we call good. He did all of these things anyway because he cared so much. Early on in this gospel, when Jesus had a very long after-dinner conversation with Nicodemus. Remember Nicodemus? Do you remember Nicodemus? Remember Nicodemus, right? Long conversation. He said something that we in this country see unfurled from tears in stadiums and from the rafters in basketball courts, John 3:16. God so loved the world that God sent an only Son so that those who believe in him might have life. Jesus, the chip off the old block. Now, if God so loved the world as Jesus claimed, then Jesus' life and his ministry was the proof of that love. And he didn't stop with himself. He taught the first disciples, and through them, the long communion of saints, which includes us, to prove it too. A religious thinker and Episcopalian, Tom Erich, in one of his blogs this week, put it this way. When people put aside self-interest and think of others, even strangers, the reign of God has appeared. Some of that reign might be as dramatic as the ministry of Jesus. Some might be small acts of grace. But it's important for us to remember that what Jesus did was really only a large version of what we can do as individuals and communities. Jesus wasn't a doer of magic. He reached outside himself and cared for people. He wasn't a Marvel superhero whose superpowers we can approximate. He showed a path that we're quite able to follow. Young Wiley followed, and so did some of those other gutsy kids. So what do you think this fifth Sunday of Lent? Is this the kind of attitude? Are these the kind of practices worth living? Not just for the little remainder of these 40 days, but throughout our lifetimes.